Welcome to You, Me, and the Dogs, the podcast where we explore the wonderful world of pet ownership. Join me every Wednesday as my guests and I share personal stories, insights, and experiences, of course, with dogs.
On today's episode of You, Me, and the Dogs, I wish I would be able to take a stroll with Cam from Hunt Away Wild. Instead, we're doing a Zoom meeting, right, Yves?
Let's get out.
Hi, Nelly.
Hi, Cam. How are you?
I'm very good. Can you hear me okay?
Yes. I really appreciate you doing this.
Oh, my pleasure. No problem at all. I'm a little disappointed by the weather in Florida behind you, though. It doesn't look quite as warm and as I imagined it would.
But, it is with the theme of the podcast. So I did want to bring some, outdoor flavor to the session.
Good idea.
I'm really excited about your brand. My dog Yanko eats it every day. I give him a cube every day, no matter if it's even another brand. If I give him that cube, it's consistent.
Oh, good. And I'm always curious as to what people do with the cubes. So for my terrier, I kind of smash it up with a fork like it was a Ricardo or something. But what do you do? How do you serve it for your dog?
Well, so the first time I was so intrigued by the square. And so I poked it with a fork, and the first time he just was give me the fork, but I smash it.
Yeah. I served it some different ways over the holiday period. We were staying with some friends and there were three dogs, and thankfully they were all older dogs, good social habits, and they got on well. And so I took some of the frozen food away with me, and the weather was very hot, and so we fed it to them frozen, and they all really enjoyed it. They kind of worked their way around the cube, kind of turned the cube into a ball, and then the ball into a smaller ball, and then it disappeared. Normally we're in the routine of kind of always thawing a cube or two for our terrier all the time, and she loves it. And she was the first dog to try it, and the first one to kind of helped me with developing the recipe, which started in beginning of 2020 during the first lockdown.
Right. How did that begin? Was it because I think it's your dog Darcy?
Yeah, that's right. And okay, she's 11 now, and she's always eaten food. And for us, it felt logical. I'd grown up with dogs that ate different things, probably when the range that was available in New Zealand anyway was a little less. We grew up with dogs that ate biscuits and canned food and things like that, and there just weren't the options available. And then when we got Darcy, almost immediately we started to experiment with kind of some of the raw frozen products that were around locally. And New Zealand has an abundance of good raw materials, so there's some really interesting products out there. And my experience was in the meat business. I've worked in the meat business, the edible meat business, all my life. And I've worked a lot with New Zealand lamb and beef, and also worked in the meat business in the United Kingdom for 10 years as well. And during that period, I made a lot of good connections in the venison industry. And we've worked with both farmed and wild venison. And I had a business with some hunters for 3 years before COVID started. So we began about the end of 2016, I think. And one of the main elements of that business was the strong demand for the meat and for the pet food raw materials like bones and organs and other things in the US. And I was kind of intrigued by this, and we were seeing this demand in New Zealand from kind of intermediaries that were buying these materials and sending them up to the US. And then in 2019, a lot of that demand just stopped. And I suspect it was someone like a General Mills or a Purina or someone decided, hey, we've got enough venison. But it was interesting when that stopped, it was maybe 35-40% of the revenue of our business was selling these types of raw materials. So it made me curious. It made me think, well, it's a weakness in our business if we don't know what people want and, you know, where this demand is coming from. If we're just selling it to a kind of nameless, faceless corporation, then we're at the whim of their buying decisions. You know, wouldn't it be better to take this product, turn it into something that, you know, we could be proud of and get to know the people who are using it? And that was really a core part of it, not just the using something that we had, but also turning it into something where we got a better connection with customers. And that's fascinating. One of the most fun parts of the picture is my wife always jokes with me about getting messages from people about my dog's stool has never looked better. And so 30 years of working industry, I now wake up to social media messages complimenting me on the immaculate stool that we're producing from this dog food.
But it's kinda important.
You gotta take compliments where you get them, that's for sure. And I'll take anything.
I'm very curious because also coming from a place where I made dog treats and made dog food, sourcing is a very important thing, even for humans, right? When you start learning, you think, oh my gosh, what am I eating? Or at least that's what I started, you know, in the States, you kind of question everything. But there is also this movement where they say American made, you know, meat is better, where I disagree. I mean, depends where it comes from, right? I would say Switzerland has, you know, a lot of these, a lot of features that are very wonderful here, you know?
Yeah, New Zealand has a good reputation for its meat products and its environment. You know, I think like anywhere in the world, we can always do better and, you know, we're acutely aware of that. It's a relatively young country that has been messed around with, you know, in terms of introduced species and things like that. And I think it was actually Theodore Roosevelt that introduced deer to New Zealand. And we have several kinds of deer in New Zealand, but the predominant one is red deer. And to a lesser degree, we have wapiti, also known as elk. We do have access to elk in New Zealand, some white-tailed deer and a few other breeds that you might find in the US. But what's very different here is that hunting is relatively egalitarian. Pretty much anyone can do it. In your own time, there are areas of the country managed by the Department of Conservation where just about any recreational hunter can go most of the year. And then there are periods during the raw where those areas are balloted out to particular hunters. We get a lot of people from the United States and from Europe coming to New Zealand for hunting, for trophy hunting. And there's a separate industry around that. But deer have found the environment here very conducive to their growth, and we have no idea how many. Our estimate in the wild is, you know, probably approaching 1 million feral deer in New Zealand. We base that on the United Kingdom, believes they have 2 million, and New Zealand is probably on its way to that kind of number if we don't control them better. And anecdotally, we see them everywhere. If you're out walking some of the beautiful national parks in New Zealand, you're likely to see them. Farmers see them on the margins and borders of their land and some of the larger properties in the South Island. And they cause a lot of damage both within the environment and on farms where they're eating crops. And specifically in the environment, they tend to be harming soil, which winds up making its way into waterways. And they are selective browsers. So they choose, like humans, I guess, what they like the flavor of and the texture of, and they eat certain plants, and that can then distort the canopy that grows in the forest as a result. So apart from that, they are also an ungulate, so they're out there, you know, kind of belching and farting like a sheep or a cow or a bull would be doing, albeit to a lesser degree. So New Zealand clearly has a problem with them. There is a strong demand for the meat. I think people in particular in Europe understand the benefits of the meat. It's lean, it's healthy, and a lot of those same benefits apply to pets. So when we were looking at the beginning of COVID, I'm locked at home with Darcy and my family. What are we going to do to kind of fill the time in? Let's make some pet food. And so Darcy tried the first few prototypes and survived and seemed to thrive and seemed to really enjoy it. And gradually we iterated those recipes and then felt we were ready to submit the recipe for some analysis. And there is a university in New Zealand, Massey University, which is recognised by AAFCO as being one of the institutions that can test and determine adherence with their claims. And they were able to help us iterate the recipe further and work out where we had some gaps in vitamins and minerals. And that's a really interesting point. If you, if you don't mind me going down a short road. It felt like probably the toughest decision in developing the product was that adding of the some people call it a macro mix, a vitamin pack, that type.
Exactly. Yeah.
It felt like a real cop out. It felt like
I agree with you.
We're short on a few relatively obscure vitamins and minerals, and really we have to go and put this powder in to sort of fill the gap. There must be another way to do it. And there is. You could work your way through a number of natural fruits, vegetables, and other products to try to fill in those gaps and continue to iterate. But it would take a very, very long time. And so we went ahead and we used a vitamin pack to begin with. And then we were able, a year or two later, to halve the number of vitamins and minerals that we were adding to the recipe and replace them with natural sources. And I'm not allowed to say too much at the moment because Celeste would tell me that, but we're pretty close to kind of finishing that exercise and always looking to get back to that completely natural kind of status. We think we're pretty close to being able to do that. And I wanted to circle back on something else you said about the combination of kind of New Zealand and the US.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's a really interesting point. We surveyed our customers, you know, what resonates with you, sourced from and made in New Zealand, sourced from and made in the US, sourced from New Zealand and made in the US.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, the results that came back were roughly one third. There was no clear preference really as to what. I think if you're open and honest and transparent with people about where your raw materials come from, then they are, you know, they're going to keep an open mind and you know, you've got an opportunity to earn their trust. In our case, what's really unique is that we do control our supply chain all the way from the wild animal right the way through primary processing, secondary processing, and final delivery. So I couldn't say from a particular cube tell you exactly where it had come from, but I could from a pack and a carton say to you, here's the day of processing, here are the deer that we processed that day, and we actually have the GPS coordinates of every deer that we processed.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, if you really wanted to nerd out and get on a digital mapping app and say, hey, that's where my dog's food came from, you could do that. And that is something that in the future, I expect we'll be able to do
I'm very tickled because I have two brothers that are hunters. And I kind of wanted to talk to them a little bit, you know, to get some insights about their hunting experience. And one thing that they told me was that they will always remember the spot that they shot the deer or they found the deer. And you saying this, I'm like, oh my God, I would totally want to know where that deer came from.
Yeah.
And what environment it was. It tells a lot more of the story, you know, about the food.
The spot is part of it, and it's going to, strangely enough, you could return there in a year as a hunter, and there's a good chance you'd find another animal there. And it's not so much the territorial nature of the animal, it's just more that there would be something fundamental about that spot, access to water, sunlight, feed, whatever it might be, that drew deer there. And, you know, they cover a lot of range. They tend to have kind of trails that they will run and a kind of an area that they will inhabit. And they are somewhat territorial, and obviously the stags at certain times of the year become very territorial. But
mating.
For us, it tends to be South Island, Otago, which Otago would be similar maybe in a US context to Colorado, kind of mountainous area. It's got some famous ski locations there and a lot of good, you know, kind of outdoor activities. It's also becoming justifiably famous for its fruit and its wine and other things too. It has quite a nice climate in the summer. But as a result, it has a lot of deer. And the majority of the deer that we get tend to be from the western part of Otago. And it really is a beautiful scenic part of the world. It's quite inaccessible. We do use helicopters often to recover the deer. And that's just a matter of practicality. That could be something in 10 or 15 years that's managed by a drone. But for now, it tends to be helicopters, and those are helicopters that would often be operating in commercial agriculture or in tourism or other areas. But they're used mostly to recover the deer and bring them back, and they're brought back to a truck. They're dressed in the wild, so they're gutted in the wild, and one of the things we don't offer, as you might see in our range, is venison tripe. And the reason for that is the animal being wild, it has to be gutted in the wild, and we have to leave that there. Our hunters will typically dig a pit and bury that stomach contents in there, so those don't come back to the factory. The deer come back, they're fully inspected, and an independent inspector goes over the animal looking for any signs of lesions or disease, anything like that. It's really important to note that New Zealand doesn't have CWD, chronic wasting disease. And that's a really unfortunate disease that sadly is spreading, you know, further and further throughout the US. As someone who lived in the UK during the mad cow kind of period of time, you know, that's a really unnerving thing for people, especially enthusiastic hunters, to, you know, to be worried about CWD coming into their area. And, you know, we feel very, very sympathetic for the plight of hunters in the US who are probably, you know, facing losing access to some of those deer in future unless something can be done to control the disease. But we don't have that in New Zealand. We do have very strict requirements on people visiting New Zealand where they've been. If they've been, for example, you know, doing outdoor pursuits like hunting or hiking, then often our border teams will ask for people to, you know, clean their shoes at the border and other things like that when they're coming in. So New Zealand is really diligent about that, and thankfully we've managed to avoid most of those things to date, including CWD. So the typical things that an inspector would be looking for: occasionally a deer can pick up tuberculosis from another wild animal, for example, but that's pretty rare. The areas in New Zealand where that exists are very, very limited. And but every single deer is given that full inspection. And if for any reason it's not suitable for human and animal consumption, then it's basically sent for rendering, which is, we don't use any rendered products right. in our recipes. So our products are a combination of meat, bone, and offal. And the offal is all the offal. We call it the pluck, and it's basically all of the respiratory organs, the liver and the kidneys as well, spleen too, and the trachea and lungs and so forth. All of that is used in natural proportions. So we think that's one of the other things that's unique about our product is it's not just liver and meat and something like that. There's an awful lot of pet foods out there that are, you know, hey, let's take some beef liver and meal or something else.
Exactly. And then like the spleen, for example, or the pancreas or the lungs, they offer so many different benefits to, you know, your dog as opposed to just getting liver, maybe kidney, heart, you know.
Exactly. And I think if you look at every now and again, you know, when you look at a nature documentary or something and you see a wolf or a hyena or a wild dog or something eating in the wild, they're a lot more practical than we are about, you know, what they seek out in terms of nutrition. And even when you're taking your dog for a walk, occasionally it's interesting what it seeks out for nutrition. On the margins of a park like the one you're in, for example, your dog can home in sometimes on a certain grass or a leaf or something else that has got some desirable quality for it that it just intuitively knows, whether it's fiber or
smell.
They recognize what it's useful for, and sometimes it's best just to let them, you know, kind of go ahead. But the same applies with the choice of proteins, because they don't order fillet steak, maybe unless they're in one of those little doggy cafes in Tokyo,
right?
Have Wagyu beef and things like that. But what they do seek out generally is a combination of protein, fat, and organs, and bone. And bone will satisfy other needs for them as well. So, yeah, they kind of know what they need in a lot of respects. And I think the more we can get out of their way in that respect, the better. And that's what we've tried to do. We have continually iterated the recipe to try to remove things that are too funky. I freely admit I made some mistakes in the first.
It's not perfect.
Oh, yeah. I think the first version we sent into California in 2020 had kale in it. And I thought, it's going to California. You know, Californians love kale. Let's put kale in the recipe. You know, it's a terrific idea. And there are lots of benefits to kale. Yeah. But unfortunately, like canine flatulence is not is not a great selling point. And we had a number of customers come back and report that. And we were like, okay, right, we need to change that out for something else. So there's equally nutritious options that don't have that.
How did you go about that process of like changing, because like for me it was very like, you know, I put too much of something. I started noticing maybe his digestion was a little slower, or he had more gas or something like that, and so I was like, okay, well, that whatever broccoli, let's say, for example, was too much. How did you go about that?
I think those kind of business end, analyses are critical. And
right.
You know, the crazy guy following Darcy around the park, you know, with a bag, just waiting for, you know, kind of step two of my new product development. And I think that's valid. You know, you want it to be you don't want it to be a super healthy food that's an unpleasant experience for the dog. That's not the point. The point is, not only to nourish the dog, but, you know, that they benefit in every way from that. So I think that is an important part. And then feedback is the other one, and making sure that we're listening to customers. And people's perspectives are fascinating. You know, another one that we got wrong along the way was we'd had some criticism over a choice of oil, and it was I'm trying to think. We pivoted. I wanted to use hemp originally, but that's obviously a very complicated one of legislation. Right. We might circle back to that one in 5 years, and maybe things will be a little more enlightened then. And for a time, we used flaxseed oil. Then some customers reported, "Hey, my dog has flaxseed allergy." So we took out the flaxseed oil and we replaced it with rapeseed oil. And in New Zealand, we know it is rapeseed oil. And a cousin of rapeseed is canola. And I did learn there is a difference, and actually the seed type and everything is different, but they're broadly in the same category. So a number of customers said, "Oh, you're putting canola oil in your product now." And it's like, no, we don't actually have canola in New Zealand, but we are putting rapeseed oil in there. And, you know, it was one of those scenarios where it's like, you know, "Cam, you're talking, all I'm hearing is canola oil." And we realized we had to take that out and replace it. And so that's another change that's taking place over the next couple of months. And it's frustrating that you can't change things quickly, because in our case, that supply chain from New Zealand takes a little while for those changes to take effect. But this is me neatly tying into a bow your earlier point about New Zealand sourced raw materials and US production.
Mm-hmm.
We are in the process of moving our production to the US, to Texas, the same great raw materials, but the ability to make a more consistent product in the US at a larger scale is really appealing. And it's appealing to me on a couple of levels. As a meat and meat products guy, I studied meat science at the University of Nebraska during COVID as well. That was my other kind of lockdown project. Venison is really high in iron, and so it oxidizes really quickly. And that's why sometimes you notice with our cubes, they can be a little kind of brown on the outside, and then there's this beautiful red color on the inside. And that's exposure to oxygen of the exterior of the cube. So we've developed a process with our partner in Texas that forms the cube and freezes it really quickly. So we've reduced that time that it's exposed to oxygen before it's frozen and packed. Right. And that should help preserve color even more without needing to do, you know, like any cheats, like putting beet juice or anything in there.
Right.
It's just the meat that colors it that way. So that's, yeah, that's one part of it. And the other part is that that factory can also process, and on the same line, it can either stay raw frozen or it can become freeze-dried. And we had noticed this increasing demand for freeze-dried food. I use freeze-dried food with Darcy occasionally, and it's quite convenient to have when we're traveling.
Yeah, on the go.
Temporarily run out or something like that. If I, believe it or not, even I forget sometimes to bring the raw from work. And so it's a useful backup, and it's effectively still a raw product. The food safety risks with raw products can't be, you know, understated. In our case, knowing that we have full control of the supply chain means that we can do that batch level testing throughout the process. But when people are handling a raw meat in their own homes, you would hate to think that someone gets distracted in between handling raw dog food, and then the next thing they're making themselves a sandwich and they haven't washed their hands.
Right.
You know, I think most of us that handle raw food frequently know it comes with, hey, there's some discipline involved in washing your hands, keeping your surfaces clean, keeping kind of separate storage and so forth for that. But it only takes one person, you know, maybe on a busy day to forget that, and you know, they could have a health issue. So at this new production site in Texas, we have a natural E. coli mitigation step, which is not high pressure processing, which I would not describe as natural.
Right.
But we do use a phage or phage. There's just a kind of traditional method for controlling that, and it is essentially something that just targets E. coli, and it's a processing aid that doesn't count as an ingredient, and it's not got any flavor, odor, anything like that. So that's used quite frequently in human applications, and in our case, we think it's a worthwhile addition to just reduce that potential risk of someone handling it.
Right. No, and I mean, it is, as a small business, that is something that's very scary, because this one little thing could really ruin your reputation.
I think insurance, and the other one for us selling across the US is sales tax. You know, we are lucky in New Zealand. We just have one sales tax. It's a federal sales tax, and that's it. When we're selling across the US, you know, we've got a very complicated app that has to tell everyone's sales tax in different states. And you see, especially it seems California, some locations there, someone's order comes through and there's four or five lines of sales tax on there. It looks like they've been to an expensive restaurant and ordered the five-course menu. Yeah.
So how, like in New Zealand, what is a typical dog eat? Is it similar to our food here?
It's fascinating. I would say here and in Australia, and I'm familiar with the UK and Europe too, the proportion of raw fed is much higher. I've seen in the US it's estimated at maybe 1-2% of animals. And I think probably that understates the people that combine different products. You know, you see more and more now, often for reasons of cost, which are entirely valid, that people will come up with some sort of hybrid where they have maybe a kibble the dog likes and they add something to it, or and then of course there's this whole other category of people on Instagram who create these incredible you know,
Right.
Dutch or master paintings with a Dutch head and a
Yeah.
Icelandic brass and something else. And you know, some of that's quite incredible too. But in New Zealand and Australia and UK, Germany in particular, that percentage is probably closer to 10%, maybe even more, I would say, in New Zealand. And that's partly because of the access to raw material. We are a net exporter of most of the raw materials that, you know, find their way into venison, lamb, and beef, dog foods around the world. So it's a very competitive local market. As a result, we actually don't sell much Hantaway in New Zealand. It wasn't our intention. We started the business. Yeah, I'll be totally honest with you, Nelly. I started it because I loved doing business in the US. I think, you know, people
Okay.
have they have a high expectation of service, but they're very generous with their feedback, both good and bad. And that makes developing a product a lot easier. It's a
Right.
sophisticated market in terms of e-commerce and logistics. I love the Seattle Seahawks. That's one of my things. I lived and worked in Seattle for a time. That game,
Okay.
I'm into it. And I love drinking hazy IPAs. So, you know,
Okay.
I'm kind of I'm easily convinced to the US.
Right.
And we sell to just one small boutique in New Zealand. And she is actually in our neighborhood where our office is. And she heard we had a pet food business and she was wanting something different to everyone else. And she just pestered us and pestered us until we supplied her some product. And to her credit, she's actually dedicated about a quarter of her store to a freezer and she merchandises it really well and she does a great job. So she's also a very useful person for us to have when we want to test out a new product. The fact that she's only 100 yards from our office, we can take something around there and she can run it past her customers and we can get some good quick feedback that way. We also get quick feedback by thankfully Darcy is still willing to test new recipes and that's something else that we hope to have later this year as well. We tested out some new recipes beginning of last year and recognized that probably we were running a little bit too fast in terms of trying to, you know, be a nationwide e-commerce business, also trying to get our products ranged in Chewy, which we've managed to do. And now,
Amazon.
yeah, then
Amazon.
the next step is getting the products, expanding the range a little. And I think what we're good at is novel proteins. We've got really good access from our hunters to things other than deer, and that includes rabbit, hare, also goat, elk, as I mentioned earlier. So we'll be using some of those products in new formulations. And I think what we'll try to do, rather than complicate our range and give, you know, too many options, is probably run those things as limited editions and just say to people, hey, if you want some of this for a change, if you're, you know, it's often the dog is quite happy. It's the owner that feels like, yeah, my dog needs a change. Look forward.
No, I mean, it gets addicting. Like, I know when I started, I saw a kangaroo and I was like, yeah, or like, the crazier the better, emu, you know? It, like, at least for me, it's very important to give different ranges of animals. They have different nutritional values. Like you said, venison is high in iron, and so for me, it is an important thing, especially when your dog is very active, to be able to change it up, give him different nutritionally rich animals that would benefit him.
I think it's a combination of the two things you mentioned. One, we go back to your story earlier about, you know, feeding Hantaway each day. Dogs are also creatures of habit, just as we are, and they will benefit from some routine. But then it's nice to be able to have other interesting things that you can test out with them and try them, you know, see what the benefits are to them. And as they get older, of course, their specific needs maybe become a bit clearer. We live in a really strange house that's not so large, but it's on three floors. And Darcy, being a terrier, she's following us up and down the stairs all the time. And so I'm
Joint.
always about her hips and joints. So that's why we brought in products like our hip and joint chew that we make with greenlip mussel and the paddy wax, which you might have tried. They're really good, full of glucosamine and chondroitin and all those things that are good for joints. And thankfully, she hasn't had a problem. But it's to my great frustration that I haven't been able to communicate with her to say, I'm just going downstairs for a moment. I'll be right back. Don't follow me. But of course, the moment I get downstairs, she follows me down. And then she's wondering, why is this guy turning around and going straight back up the stairs again? You know, she gets a good workout every day. But yeah, I think being alert to what those specific needs of your dog are, digestion is probably the most common one that we get told about. The one that I'm the most curious about is people reporting that their dog is a picky eater, because that's never been my experience.
Right.
And maybe it's, there's some projecting, I think, on behalf of the owner occasionally that can influence that. And also in my own learned experiences, maybe limited to just two breeds. Darcy is a Border Terrier. I'm a short wheelbase convert now. You know, I see the benefit of the smaller dog. But I grew up with Labradors and Retrievers, and they will eat anything. You know, they're either good or bad, and you've got to really watch them, and their appetite is just, you know, endless. So I've never struck a dog that you know, was that discerning and maybe what its choices of food were. But it's clear that some people, I guess like all of us, can maybe overanalyze a little bit, you know, what their dog needs. And it's like when you have a friend who, you know, they discover a spot on their arm, and the next thing they're on Google, and 5 minutes later they've got themselves buried, and you know, and you have to kind of talk them down. I think we can get a little bit that way with dogs too. And if you're observing them and you're, you know, spending quality time with them, chances are you probably got an inkling of what the root cause is.
Exactly.
And you know, we're fortunate. Darcy goes to the vet once a year for a kind of flea and tick treatment and to get her nails clipped, and that's it. We've been very fortunate that she's been in good health for the 10 or 11 years that she's been with us. And I've no doubt that that's in part to the diet that she has as well. And she seems happy with it, but she also seems always willing to try something new. So I'm
right. As is mine. Mine's is just willing to try anything. You know, you're told to feed kibble, right? This is the kibble the breeder recommends. You feed it. And he did not want to eat it. And we introduced him to raw, and he didn't want to eat it either. He started with cooked food, that's how my company first started, was cooked food. And slowly he was like, oh, raw? Yeah, give me raw. And so now occasionally I'll make him what I used to make him. But I mean, he, especially like your brand, he's like, he loves. So you say, go, forget it.
I've worked with product development for both human and animal applications. And what's most enjoyable with developing products for dogs in particular, and I'm going to be straight up, I'm a dog guy. You know, I grew up a cat, but, you know, I keep saying to my wife, you know, as soon as I die, she can have as many cats as she wants. But for now, you know, the dog is it. Although I think that she might be scheming to get a cat at some point. But anyway, we focused on dogs, and we wanted to do that well to begin with. And when you're developing products for dogs, of course, I think we tend to sometimes put our own expectations, you know, into play in terms of what a meal should look like and how it should be constructed and things like that. The cube was a practical thing, because we looked at it and thought, well, if we're shipping it from New Zealand to the US, we want it to be really space efficient. What we don't want to do is have all this wasted space and packaging just, you know, cruising halfway around the world, burning a big hole in the environment. We would like to, you know, minimize that impact and minimize the amount of storage space and minimize the amount of logistics and all of those things.
Just the thought of it, I think, like for me, it is very satisfying to know that I am taking out 3 cubes. Like if he's only eating Huntaway, 3 cubes in the morning is great for him.
Yeah.
It's so easy.
And the easiest thing a lot of other companies do is if they Because a lot of them have followed this path of maybe raw frozen and then got into freeze dried. And then what you see happen is they take the kind of intermediate product before freeze drying and they sell that as their frozen product. So you get pellets and they look like a pellet. And those pellets, there's nothing wrong with them, but they tend to freeze together and they tend to clump together if they get any kind of temperature abuse in transit. And they're much harder to portion out. So something we haven't quite worked out with our freeze-dried product yet is how do we get that same modular fixed component cube in a freeze-dried form? And we don't want to be making a big freeze-dried cube because that would be impractical for people. But, there's probably some way in which we can maybe, again, you also don't want to put a plastic scoop that then winds up in the waste. Yeah, there's a bit of work to be done there, but there is something to be said for, like you say, that modular, predictable, fixed quantity, and it complements the fact that venison's very good for weight control with dogs as well. You know, it's quite a predictable protein in that regard. So I think if you've got a dog that you've got on a maintenance diet, or that you're concerned about, you know, maybe limiting its calorie intake, then it's a good option for that type of thing. And I have noticed with the freeze dried that I get a little too generous with it sometimes.
Right. I use it a lot. I got some of the Hunt Away and I used it a lot for treats. I found it to be amazing for treats. Like it would fit in the, you know, in his toy and it would just come out when he would play with it for puzzles. It was awesome. And I think it's a great option because it has everything. It's balanced. And so, and you know, the poop is going to come, you know, it's going to come out perfect. And so it's something that he really enjoys.
No, that's for sure. And then those other features in developing products for dogs are that aroma and smell counts for a lot more than taste and flavor. Now, one of the things I've been dying to ask you is you guys occasionally do taste the food, don't you?
Yeah.
You've tasted
it? Yeah.
And unsurprisingly, it's going to taste of powdered chemicals or something if that's, you know, a big ingredient to put in there.
Interesting. So there is a brand, We Feed Raw. I'm going to say it. We made a video. We didn't say the brand, but it was We Feed Raw. And it literally tasted like you got Alka-Seltzer and you pound it and you mixed it with me. And I mean, we couldn't eat it. Like I swallowed it, but it was just not. And so for me, it's kind of like, well, why would I eat this and think it's okay for my dog to eat this? It tasted like medicine.
Yeah.
And so
that's coming back to that cop out that I mentioned.
Right.
There's several easy ways to get yourself out of, you know, it's a fine line. And I'm a little wary of being critical of other businesses because everyone takes their own approach to it. However, the easy approach, in my opinion, is let's throw a pile of vitamins and minerals in.
Yeah.
Let's pressure process it. Let's remove all the risk. It's like the old adage about ground beef where they say it's no problem, it's irradiated, and it's like, well, I don't want to be eating irradiated feces. The fact that it's irradiated is irrelevant. I really want, you know, a clean natural product. And I think that knowing our supply chain and being able to manage that, being able to manage those mitigations, I think we can always do it better, but we believe we've tried to find a middle ground, or you know, a happy medium where we're making the product as naturally as we can, we're processing it minimally, and we're, you know, intervening with it to the barest minimum that we can to still produce a safe product. And it's something that, you know, we have to keep in mind is going to find its way into people's freezers and refrigerators and other things alongside food that they eat. And, you know, you've got this really privileged position in people's homes, a product that, you know, crosses their doorway and makes its way into their kitchens, and that they and their family and their children might handle, and obviously that their dog winds up eating. And I think you have to take that really seriously and always be thinking about the risks with it. But at the same time, it's a fascinating increasingly blurry boundary between our expectations of what a dog should eat and you know, what we eat ourselves. But I don't like the idea of Darcy eating anything with those kind of characteristics that you described.
You just don't know where they, like, where did they come from and what was the processing, you know, like how high end is this as opposed to, dirt, you know? To me though, like, I'm going to try yours. I will be trying yours. Venison is something that I don't eat that much, so I'm trying to acquire a taste for it. But it is on my to-do list because for me, it is important. But I mean, to be honest with you, just looking at the product for me, you could really tell it doesn't have barely anything that's not natural.
Yeah, like, and I think you can see some deliberate natural inconsistency in the product. If it's too homogenized, if it's too identical from one cube to the next, that's not Hunterway. You know, in the case of Hunterway, you should get some natural variation in it. That is over the course of a week. That means that your dog is getting, you know, a little bit of everything that's named in the pack there, and getting all those benefits in the right proportions. That's another area of debate. You get a lot of people in Europe, in Germany in particular, they really advocate for the BARF diet. You see lots of different suggestions in the US, and by and large, we've tried to steer clear of that type of debate. We've tried to say, well, look, we're aiming to make the best product we can. We're not really adhering to anyone's particular rule book or anything like that.
Right.
We are using, you know, all parts of the animal in roughly natural proportion. And that is, we think, a pretty reasonable basis for starting. And then what we were left with in New Zealand were things like the skins. And so the skins we actually had processed and made collagen and then made a chew using the collagen. And I'm not sure if there's anything about the customer base, but on Chewy, that's the biggest seller. And it's quite fascinating. As people get more used to using collagen, you know, for their skin, for their joint health, or other things like that, and clear of what the benefits are, then they become more familiar with maybe using that for pets as well. In my mind, I'm imagining these kind of like little Beverly Hills chihuahuas, you know, getting fed their collagen. But I suspect it's dogs of all shapes and sizes and in all different parts of the country. I think there's certain things that we think are, beneficial for us that we're inclined to project and say, well, the same would apply to my dog, or I would expect the same benefits.
Right.
Yeah, I think the other things for us to think about are how sustainable those ingredients and raw materials are too. So, and sustainable in both senses of the word, from a business sense, can I, if I've got that trusted relationship with that family, with that dog, and the dog develops a taste for it, you know, can I ensure that we can supply that family year round? Do we have enough of this raw material? And then also sustainable from the perspective of, could we do this year after year? Is this something that's contemporary in terms of environmental concerns, in terms of, you know, can we defend it? Can we, where does it fit in terms of the whole debate about farming of animals, water usage, soil erosion, even in terms of plant-based and cell-based meat products? I liked the idea that wild is like this little subset all of its own.
Right.
And it's quite defendable one. You know, it's these animals already exist. No one's calling them into being specifically to be, you know, processed into meat or anything like that. They are out there in the wild. They are, we believe, creating, you know, negative environmental effects in a lot of cases.
Right.
And the control of them. And the phrase that we've tried to use is thoughtful harvesting. We don't want to go in and wipe all the deer out. There's lots of people who get enjoyment out of recreational hunting of those deer, and being able to work with those people, in a collegial way. We tend to get the majority of our deer from land around big stations, big extensive stations that have an element of natural boundaries around them, where deer accumulate. And we don't get so many from the Department of Conservation land in New Zealand, but we have in the past. We think that those two needs of controlling that deer population and recreational hunting, and even frankly the needs of the trophy hunters and things like that, all need to kind of be balanced and try and come to some sort of happy medium.
In the United States, I mean, I'm not sure 100% if, well, I think you guys also do get, you have to have a license and stuff like that, in order to hunt. But in the United States, it's a little taboo, right? So people think like, oh, there's a hunter and he's hunting everything and killing everything. And the reality is that's not the case at all. It's very hard for a hunter to first find his prey. He's walking several miles, you know, into nature. And it could be a very scary environment for them. And so they're waiting for the perfect, you know, in the United States, there are certain places where you could just get one venison. That's it. And so they're just waiting for the perfect hatch. And when you, you know, talk to people that aren't educated, they just think like, oh, well, they're not thinking about conservation and they're not thinking about sustainability and they're not thinking about those things. But a lot of the times, at least in the United States, the conservation part of it is funded by the hunters.
Yeah, that's right. You know, what happens to the revenue from those tickets or tags rather. Mm-hmm. So I find the wild game sector in the US fascinating. You know, there's some examples across the country of, you know, very different approaches to control of wildlife and how wildlife interacts. And inevitably you get the classic human intervention scenario of we created this externality somehow, the salmon one is fascinating. You know, you put dams and rivers, you interfere with salmon's right, so to help the salmon overcome that, we'll build fish ladders. And then you get this compounding effect of needing all of these other interventions to kind of make this whole process work, when in reality, if you just didn't kind of do the first thing, you wouldn't have had to have had all that extra effort afterwards. I mean, I totally understand people's need for water and power and other things is valid too. But we had it in New Zealand frequently with introduction of species to catch or control other species that had been introduced. So, you know, something gets introduced to control another species, and the next thing you know, you've got two problems. So, wherever you go, the kind of common issue tends to be human intervention. But you do have these fascinating premises throughout the US of, and I hope they survive, and I hope that they carry on into the future, that you've got these really talented butchers working across the country with vastly different days of work each day. A farmer says, hey, I've got some cattle on my farm that I want to process for my own consumption. Can I bring them in? A hunter shows up with, you know, his white-tailed deer. It could be a bison. It could be, in some cases, I've heard of mountain lion being processed for consumption and other things like that. And, you know, these guys and girls handle all sorts of things on any given day. And, you know, I find that fascinating. And there's some really good examples to follow on Instagram of people in that space and have, you know, very different days work every day. But what tends to happen is what they would call waste products. So the offals and the bones and so forth will often stay with the processor. Yeah. In some cases, people will take them if they have a dog and they know what to do with it, or maybe they have a grinder at home, or they have something else that they could process it with. But in some cases, the processor keeps those things. And you do see in some cases those processors experimenting with selling that product as a, if their state allows it, as a pet food product. And yeah, there's some benefit to a dog consuming some of those things, but they don't go that next stage of making them complete or balanced and all balanced. And as a result, probably the product's can be a little bit more haphazard, but you can still find some interesting things.
Yeah. Right. So let's talk a little bit about the sustainability of Huntaway. I find we were talking about your packaging for the freeze dried and I loved it. It was so simple. The packaging of the raw is just super simple. Like once you receive it, you're like, I get it. There's a lot of thought into the product packaging. And so I'm sure that the whole process is also figured out that way.
Yeah, that's right. So starting with the raw material, and any new raw materials we look at have to have the same sustainability credentials. So the goat, even though on the goat products it often doesn't say that it's wild, there's a reason for that. Goats are harder to collect from a hunting perspective. And if you imagine even from a butchery perspective, it's the same number of cuts and processes on an animal that's much smaller. So economically, processing a goat in the same factory we process venison in is problematic. What tends to happen with goats is that they're actually mustered in the wild. So someone will go and collect them into a truck, and then they will process them through a regular slaughterhouse, even though the animal might have spent a lot of its time in the wild, a majority of its time. But they tend to be another good, sustainable choice of protein. A number of the stations that our hunters operate on and around have issues with rabbits and hare increasingly in New Zealand. And I don't. Do you get hares in the US? The sort of like larger rabbit.
Yeah, in Colorado, my dog tried to catch.
yeah. Good luck, because they're really fast. They're really fast. They're also very lean and good eating. And there are different ways of harvesting and processing those. To best advantage. When we were looking for material for the chew products, New Zealand green shell mussels or green lip mussels are a sustainable process that's recognised by the Monterey Bay Aquarium as meeting their standard of a sustainable fishery. And that was our main criteria. We did test a raw frozen product that had some sustainable white fish with it. It just had a few funky texture issues and we weren't quite happy with it. So we kind of gone back to the drawing board on that one. And then it turned out through looking and keeping our eyes open and our ears open whilst developing that mussel product, a number of the mussel companies in New Zealand said, hey, we have a problem with blue shell mussels and they are a pest. And they occur in and around the mussel farms and they have the same amount of chondroitin and glucosamine pro rata or pound for pound is the green lip one. So, why don't you use those? That's something that we're working on maybe for the future. We were very much trying to minimize any waste in the process. And so that's hence we came up with that use for the skins. And then with bones, we're working on, because even after removing all the meat from the bones, you're left with some, some bone paste, which we can incorporate that to some degree into the raw frozen and freeze-dried recipe. But some of the harder bones, like the femur bones in particular, the round bones, they're harder to process, but they can be used for broth making. So we've got some broth products coming out later in the year, and we're excited by the potential for those to be used together with the freeze-dried and some of the treats and other things as a way of wetting product out, and also potentially as a way of hydrating pets and dogs in a nutritious way as well. And bone broth is something I think that people are more and more aware of the benefits of it in terms of the collagen and other goodness that you can derive from it. That trying to use everything was kind of step one, and making sure also that that we were comfortable with the environmental story of each of the raw materials, and then trying to keep as many of those raw materials and ingredients sourced close to where we're manufacturing was another part of that equation. And then in the choice of packaging, that's a really fast developing field. And we went from a big box in 2020 down to a kind of smaller box in 2021, and an even smaller box with the same contents, same weight in it. Mm-hmm. In 2022. So we think we came up with a really compact, well-designed product. The bags need some improvement, and that's coming this year.
Right.
It's always, you're with a small growing business, you're often doing the right thing, but you might be doing it in the wrong sequence. You know, you might be, right. In our case, I like product development, so we developed a whole lot of products really quickly. And then you're committing to buying packaging, and sometimes you're buying too much packaging. Something sells really well, something doesn't sell so well. You end up, you know, with these different cadences of product development. But you've seen, I think, the treat and chew products that have the compostable packaging. And that is a really nice package. But composting differs wildly from one state and one municipality and one city to the next. Some people have access to home composting, others to municipal, you know, industrial composting. And some of the benefits of that get lost quite quickly. Recyclable or compostable bags for the frozen, you know, there's benefits and otherwise too. But you're trying to kind of fit with what is the lowest common denominator for people. So more and more what we're seeing with plastic is that is single film plastic or a single substrate rather than layers and layers of film. So we have some bags at the moment that do have multiple layers of film, and we're gradually phasing those out so that as the year goes on, we'll have more and more single film bags, and they can be recycled anywhere. You know, literally everywhere in the US and in New Zealand and any of the other countries that we're thinking of selling to, they can handle that that type of product. And then I think you've got to always be looking right through your supply chain at, you know, how can we minimize our footprint? And the next step for us with that is around waste, because there's nothing more frustrating both for a dog owner with a hungry dog and, you know, a small growing business than when a courier messes up a delivery or it goes missing somewhere. And the solutions to that are many and varied, but there are some things we can do technologically in terms of working out, hey, Nellie's in Florida, where she lives, UPS offers the best service or FedEx offers the best service. Knowing when we're about to consign something to you from our Pennsylvania location, for example, that, hey, there's a big storm coming and we maybe need to route this in a different direction. Right. We've got a new logistics partner that we're talking to around that piece, that technological kind of piece to minimize the risk of things going wrong and take some of the randomness out of that part of it. Because delivering perishable, when you think about it, 10 or 20 years ago, it was pretty much unheard of. Now, you know, throughout COVID, I think people got more and more familiar with, oh, I can just order some ice cream from my sofa and it arrives frozen a day later, you know, things like that. So we've gone from no expectations to very high expectations really quickly. We want to make sure that things get there safely and as quickly as possible. A good rule of thumb is the shortest time in transit, you know, is going to deliver the best quality product. And I know that sounds obvious, but it means it goes through less depots, less, you know, circuitous routes around the country, routes around
more
the country.
More frustration.
More frustration. Someone tracking on their phone. Hey, where's my delivery? It's, whoa, what's it doing in Albuquerque? You know, all this kind of thing. And so I think there's a fine line between having enough inventory in the right locations and being able to get it to people, you know, without a ridiculous amount of dry ice in a package that's far too large or anything like that. And I think the other thing that everyone struggles with at the moment, the growth in perishable and e-commerce logistics has been so rapid that there's not really many people who are expert in it. You know, a lot of people right from the kind of hardworking folk in the cold stores who are packing the orders through to the businesses that have grown quickly, often because they've had a lot of supercharged investment, to the, you know, the final delivery by courier. All of that has happened really fast. And so I think, you know, there's a lot of learning taking place on the go, and you know, we've been part of that. It can be frustrating, but the main things are that if you're trying to reduce the repeat occurrences, and you know, ultimately it'll work.
Right. But it's a lot of orchestration, as well, you know, that part of it is behind the scenes, you know, I, as a customer, doesn't know this.
Good point. We have someone in the first of our team to wake up is in Vermont, and the last of our team to go to sleep is in New Zealand. And that way we're covering, you know, most of the day, probably 20 waking hours, something like that, that we're covering. And straight away you pick things up like, hey, you know, why is this order where we've got plenty of inventory? Why has it not been picked? And you discover that they're short staffed, or that the courier didn't call in to the depot, and you've always got to be kind of on the case, chasing those things along. You see some crazy things from time to time. We had one recently where someone got a whole lot of treats packed in a case with dry ice, and our logistics partner was very apologetic, and they said, "Look, we have just had such a big growth. We're hiring people so fast that sometimes training isn't optimized quite how we would like it to be." And they're very apologetic about that. But it's a fascinating sector to be in. It's a really rewarding one. It's one where you have the benefit of seeing the good that your product can do. And it kind of passes what I refer to as the dinner party test of, you know, I like nothing better than sitting next to someone at a dinner party and telling them what I do and what I work with and the product and all the great features of it and the lovely people we get to work with. And I could count on one hand, out of the thousands of people that have bought the product, the people that didn't fit that description, you know, that maybe weren't very nice. But that's very rare. And chances are that in any group of people, you're going to find that kind of strike rate. But I think even disproportionately lower in our customer base. They're very generous with their time, generous with their feedback, patient when, you know, they see things not going well in most cases. And we're really lucky in that regard. And it helps to be delivering a product to people that they're looking forward to and that their dog is looking forward to. And, you know, it's not like taxes or worm treatments or other things like that where maybe people know they have to do it but they're less enthusiastic about it.
Right. I want to thank you so much. I really, really loved talking to you.
No problem. No, my pleasure. We from the moment, you know, we saw that you'd bought the product, because I like to, the nice thing is the business is still small enough that we can kind of still look in. I can still look into who's bought this product, who's this lady, you know, do a little bit of research. And I think what makes the pet industry fun is people like you who are passionate about it and who, you know, like to look under the hood and like to, you know, peel the curtain back and see what's going on within the business. And, you know, not everyone is a corporate behemoth who won't answer questions or anything like that. It's my favorite topic. I like nothing better than talking about it. So anytime, let me know. And we'll make sure we keep an eye out on both the website and the channel for all the cool stuff that you've got coming up.
I thank you so much.
No problem. And I hope that cloud goes away and the sun, you're back to sunshine.
We hope you enjoyed this episode. If you want to know more about our guests, read the show notes down below. And of course, join us next Wednesday for another possum episode of Yumi and the Dogs. Bye.